24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. Today is Wednesday, the 12th of October. I hope you're having a fantastic day. Got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about sales transparency. We've talked about transparency in so many things, salaries and all the other aspects of your business. But now we're going to be talking about sales transparency, a new idea for me. But before that, we're going to meet with the former president of Reebok, HBO. He was also the CEO of Indian Motorcycles, an amazing career. Frank O'Connell is with us. So we got a great show. Appreciate you being with us. And it's kind of busy, so we're going to have to go ahead and get started. We're going to do that right now. Very excited and honored to introduce my first guest. This is one of the most impressive resumes you've ever seen. President of Reebok, president of HBO Video, the CEO of Indian Motorcycles, chairman and CEO of Gibson Greeting Cards, an amazing career of building and rebuilding businesses. And he has just released a new book called Jump First, Think Fast, An Unconventional Approach to High Performance. Got a really clever cover with half of it upside down. Please welcome to the show, Frank O'Connell. Frank, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm just sitting here in Woodstock, Vermont, enjoying our conversation.
Well, I can attest that there is no place more beautiful than Woodstock, Vermont in the fall. So you live in a beautiful spot. Tell us about the book, Frank. When do I do my thinking? Jump first. I jump before I think.
Yes, well, You know, the purpose why I wrote the book really was to encourage kind of this new generation on how to take risks and think differently. And what I wanted to do was really share all my experiences on the jump first, think fast, and let people draw from those experiences, you know, messages instead of kind of writing, do this, you know, do that. So, you know, in many of these cases, yes, you don't have all the information to take the risk. And, you know, that's when I encourage you to move. And then if it doesn't work, I call it air correct, you know, change, be agile, you know. But yes. You can't grow. You can't grow a company. You personally can't grow in my opinion, you can't grow in a relationship, whatever, unless you're taking these kind of risks and jumping into the unknown and having self-confidence that once you jump, you can start dealing with all the variables.
All right. I love this. Frank, one of the thesis points of this radio show is that risk is bad and that serial entrepreneurs do everything they can to reduce risk. They use other people's money. They pre-sell whatever they can, get contracts up front so that it's not that risky, and that entrepreneurs, again, the serial entrepreneurs who do it again and again and again, don't take that much risk, that they hate it. They'd rather, you know, leave that for the bungee jumpers. What are your thoughts?
Well, there's no question about, yes, you should do everything to mitigate risk. And I, you know, when an entrepreneur comes to me, you know, I immediately take them through and ask them some really critical questions to determine, you know, how well do they have a strategic plan? And that plan should, of course, identify all the competition, all the trends, all the risks, what they're going into, so that you can start to judge, you know, are they inventing in the right area? Do they really understand the market? And are they mitigating the risks? But ultimately, in my opinion, you can't eliminate, particularly in this environment, you can't take the risks down, you know, extremely low, because you'll also probably take down the opportunity. So, you know, I have to say my needle is up on the other end. I want to see all the preparation, everything else, and the good planning. But I just believe the problem is with many people, they have a great idea, they set on it, or they're in a situation, a bad situation, either in their company or in their current company, and they don't move. They don't move off of it, you know, because they can't be assured that they are going to be, you know, successful. And learning to deal with failure, to me, is extremely important. There are lots of lessons, and being able to gain great confidence in that and not worry and panic about the risk, I think, is critical to success.
So. Yes, I agree with most of what you said, but I do want to get the risk down just as low as possible. One of our little rules here is that, you know, we're not trying to build Reebok here. We're not trying to build a $1 billion company. I want people to get off the sofa, destroy the remote control. And as you said, the inertia is one of the horrible things. And if we can convince you that, you know, you're not going to build a $20 million business this way, but if you can build a $1 million business that throws off a couple $100,000 a year for you, and if you can do that by testing the marketplace with, say, only $5,000, the amount that you would spend on a week at Disney, for example, that's the sort of risks that I can handle. I can live with that. And if I succeed, if my $5,000 proves that there's a market, well, then I'm willing to take a little bit more risk and double mortgage your house. I am, Frank, willing to double mortgage your house.
Well, listen, first, I agree with you on, you know, we use, and I encourage entrepreneurs to use every technique, one, proof of concept. You know, I'd say, okay, for not much money, you know, in particular, I'm dealing in consumer products. So my whole area is understanding the consumer behavior. So there are all sorts of inexpensive techniques to start with. I always say when they walk in the door and they've got a great plan and product, I said, show me your consumer research. What have you done? Both, you know, the most basic stuff. I've gone to all these stores. I've researched all my competition. Yes, I've done some initial conceptual research, etc. So that, you know, that to me is the area where you start really limiting, you know, your research. Is there a market for your product? How big is that market? What is the competition? How is it shifting? So doing that homework to me is the risk mitigation part that is critical, particularly for me in dealing with, dealing with new consumer products.
How different is selling consumer products versus B2B sales?
I think it is quite different because you have very rapid changing consumer behavior now taking place. Okay, and you've got to try to stay ahead of that and keep predicting about what's going to happen. So you've got to be far more agile than you used to be. And I would say more agile than kind of in the, you know, in the B2B world. The second part of that, and there is always a B2B component, is with any consumer product, yes, you may be going directly on the internet. But if you have anything to do with retail channels of distribution, your customer ends up being as critical as your consumer. How are you going to reach your consumer? And that really is the customer, which is really a B2B, you know, much more of a B2B relationship. But I just think the consumer side of it just moves much faster and is more intensive.
And how are consumers changing right now? What is the post-pandemic possible recession consumer look like
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we wish we all could figure that one out, and we're all trying to figure it out. You know, I have one company we're involved with, and we're a huge producer of private label food products. So during the pandemic, of course, private label went through the roof. The question is now, is that going to sustain? Did we really grow the private label, you know, market now? And will it end up at a higher level, or will people return to just, you know, classic brands? You know, so that's, you know, one area. Big area, of course, is everybody is sorting out. We do quite a bit of research on Zs and millennials, you know, in terms of, you know, what is changing in their, you know, buying behavior and their needs. And that is still, I have to say, is pretty hard. We are researching all the time. Still pretty hard to, you know, still pretty hard to predict. We know that they're much more influenced by peer group information than they are by advertising, as an example. You know, I have a great toy company that's going through the roof. And, you know, we're really in we learn pretty fast. We're not in the toy business. We're in the child development and educational business. So well-educated millennial moms now are reacting very differently than the prior moms, as an example.
Yes. Selling to parents and moms is different. That's how I started my entrepreneurial career, Frank. My first business was in summer camps. We were the world's largest summer camp company with 90 camps running simultaneously. And so we spent a lot of time selling to mom. And that's always a challenge.
So. Yes. Yes.
And our consumers now, do you have a sense, are the consumers leading this recession? You can get into a recession a lot of different ways, and you can get out of a recession in a lot of different ways. I feel like that this recession, if we're in one, let's not argue about that, but I feel like that the consumers led this recession. And, you know, because I'm not spending as much now. I'm trying to pull back personally. I feel like I'm a bellwether for the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I can only agree with you, is that it's the consumer behavior that really has put us into, you know, put us into the recession. You know, this great fear of what's going to take place going forward, everybody kind of cutting, you know, cutting back, you know, we're lots of confusion in the job market, you know. So I would say, yes, it's much more driven by consumer behavior and consumer confidence here going forward than about anything else.
How do you deal with an iconic brand? And I'm particularly thinking of the Indian motorcycles. The motorcycle consumer, whether they're an Indian buyer or not, is very loyal, it seems. There's the incredible, great, all of us who got our MBA, we all did that Harvard business case about Harley Davidson and their quality issues back in the 70s. Can you convert a Harley buyer to an Indian buyer, or am I only buying because of the brand name and I don't care how much it leaks?
Oh boy, that's a good question. You know, the interesting thing was these avid motorcyclists who have Harleys. And I started, you know, I've got 15 bikes in my garage.
Wow.
So I've got, you know, and my wife is an avid rider, and we have ridden for 50 years, thousands of miles a year. So, I mean, I've ridden Harleys all over the country, and I've ridden Indians all over the country. But let me say this, I got involved with Indian, the first thing was there. You have two markets here. You know, the first market is somebody who does own a Harley. And what we would try to get them to do is consider buying an Indian in addition to a Harley, as an example, you know?
Right.
And not just convert, but get them on the seat of an Indian. And, of course, what happens is Indians are, if I pull into a lot with my Indian and there are 15 Harleys there, everybody will come over to my Indian, you know, because of still the romance with that iconic S fenders and brown leather, you know, et cetera. Now, the second group that you're really after is, you know, new riders, okay, who are coming into the motorcycle, you know, coming into the motorcycle riding, and have some awareness of the old Indian brand and the Indian DNA, you know. And we did some very interesting research, and what we found was a Harley rider basically was someone who wanted to join a cult. An Indian rider was a very independent person and an independent rider. They weren't looking to join a group. So we have really worked on those two different psychologies, and that ended up being extremely important in terms of who we sell to. The other group is a big group, is called Born Again Bikers. And these are basically people who rode probably Harleys or motorcycles earlier in their life, had children, stopped riding, and now are coming back into the market. And what we have found is they were much easier to sell an Indian to and got much more intrigued. If I could get them in the seat of an Indian and go for a test ride, they came back with a smile on their face. Their wife had never seen in years, and I could sell them the bike. So.
Have you ever ridden Dragon Tail in southern North Carolina, western Carolina?
It's called the Tail of the Dragon.
Yes, you know that ride.
I've ridden probably three times. And yes, that's it's an iconic. We've ridden almost every iconic ride in the United States and then in Europe and whatever. My group is in Spain and Portugal right now. And we've ridden all over the country. But the Tail of the Dragon, of course, is a very interesting. And they have, you know, at the base of the Tail of the Dragon, they have kind of like the Hall of Shame. And they have a tree. And in that tree, they hang all the parts of all of the bikes that went off the road going up and down the Tail of the Dragon. the Hall of Shame, they call it. Yeah, that's a great ride.
I used to have a summer home right in that area. So, a lot of fun to look at the bikers in town all the time.
Yeah.
Where do we end up with the streaming wars and our video? My wife and I counted, I think we're paying 8 monthly subscriptions for Hulu type services. And we had to re-sign up for HBO again, of course, for the new Dragon, series. I can't afford, it's not even that. I don't want 8 subscriptions. You know, I feel cheated that way. Are we going to end up with 3 eventually? The 3 big players, does the rest consolidate? We've got too many has-beens on the side, you know, that, you know, Paramount. Do they deserve their own platform? I don't know. What are your thoughts, Frank?
Yeah, and probably I don't have the crystal ball here, but I think, and I'm exactly where you are, I'm being driven nuts with all of this, the streaming services and what ones and et cetera. You know, but if I kind of look back, whether it is, you know, television, networks, you know, and then, you know, even HBO Video and whatever, it definitely tend to consolidate. And there was definitely acquisitions because there was a lot of efficiency in acquiring customers, et cetera. And then just the, you know, the constant battle for content. I think you're definitely going to see consolidation. I definitely think so. And you know, the question is how impactful will the consumer be in driving that? Is another factor. I definitely think you'll see consolidation. So,
and when you say consumers driving, do you mean people like us saying I'm not willing to write eight checks a month?
Yeah, I'm not going to put up with all of this, you know. Right. And so, yeah, I think we'll definitely.
All right. Do you have it set up so that you can ride your Indian wearing your Reeboks watching HBO while signing greeting cards?
No, I'm not. I've learned to focus, you know, really learned to focus. So I'll give you my, you know, I do all these analogies on riding motorcycles in life and entrepreneurs and whatever. And I say one of the things about riding a motorcycle is what you don't want to do is be looking down at the front wheel, which is where you are. What you want to be doing is looking up at the horizon, way up to the curves and the next blind curves, because life is like that. Being an entrepreneur is like that. You know, there are a lot of twists and turns and blind curves. Make sure you're looking up.
That's a great analogy. I love that one. Back to the book, you refer to high performance in the subtitle. What are your personal keys to exceptional performance? What do people look for when they're hiring presidents of HBO and Reebok? What are the skills? What are the traits that set you apart from the other riders, Frank?
Well, you know, the first thing they do is say, God, you know, I'm really hiring an individual here. So I got to study very carefully their track record, where they succeeded and where have they, you know, and where have they failed? The other part of that is, and I'm doing that when I'm hiring CEOs down to our private equity companies, is I now do a very deep dive into what are their skill sets, you know, and what is their fit to the situation. Do they have the skills that really are going to make, you know, a difference in this, you know, in this situation? Because that's, you know, in the end, that's most critical. I will tell you that one of the most important things in almost all of the situations I've worked into is the ability to immediately pull together a strategic plan and align the board and the whole management team on a winning direction. And then from that, to be able to create metrics, to be able to track the success. So I think they look to me, when I walk into a situation, there's almost never a strategic plan really in place, and it's desperately needed. So that's number one. Number two is the ability really to identify talent. You know, if you're turning companies around or billing it, you know, it's not plans that do it, it's talent. So then it's the ability to know what talent is required, hire that right talent, and the next is accountability. Can you drive accountability out of the strategic plan down to all levels of management and below? And the next thing they look for in me and should in this environment is agility. Things are changing fast. Can I move fast if this plan doesn't work? And the last one, I always say you can only remember five things, the first two, the last one, maybe the one in the middle. And the fifth one is culture, to be able to create from the top a winning culture that really matches the strategic plan. So those are kind of, I think, what they're looking for in me. And when I'm hiring CEOs, that's what I'm looking for.
How important was it that you grew up on a farm?
Very important. You know, it had more to do with me and who I am and any successes I've had than anything else I've done in my life. You know, I saw my father died when I was 2 and a half. My mother is a city girl, continued to run the farm. So as soon as we became teenagers, we started running the farm, or we're entrepreneurs. So, you know, we were buying machinery. I was raising thousands of chickens, et cetera. And I got great confidence. I always knew I could make a living. I started businesses at that point and we became an entrepreneur. So when I went on to college, I started with, you know, a really strong both feet on the ground.
And having that experience, I can't imagine going off to college at 18 and joining a fraternity and drinking yourself silly every Friday and Saturday night. No, I have to imagine you were a very different student.
Well, let me give you how different I was. I was married when I was 18. I had my first, I had my first child. So I was married when I was 17. I had my first child in my first semester at Cornell. So let me tell you, my career, very, very different. Let me tell you. So you definitely start, you're driven from a whole different, whole different angle. Yeah.
Wow, your wife is interesting. A motorcycle rider who put up with 20 moves and got married at 17.
Well, no, let me tell you a story. And people ask me that often. They said, were you ever in a situation where in those moves, your wife did not want to go? Well, I was married to a different woman for six years and had two children. And then, I met Barbara. But actually, that was, a very critical point, let me say, for being driven in an entrepreneur or whatever, Just one day, my wife said, I don't want to be married to a junior executive, who's going to travel all over the country and work 7 days a week. And, that was really kind of the end of that marriage, even though we stayed our family very, very close and whatever. But Barbara has really, and Barbara's an executive recruiter, so to a degree, she understood the business. But, she's been incredible in terms of making all of these moves. And she's created a very successful real estate business in the process. So,
I'm on my second marriage as well, Frank. And my first, my divorce was largely due to being an entrepreneur. Ex-wife wanted a paycheck every other Friday, and I'd come home and the first thing she would ask was, did you bring a check today or did you buy more marketing, more ads? And whenever I bought more ads, which I almost always did, it was a long weekend. So
I can appreciate that. So, yes.
Frank, we only have about a minute left. What else would you like to share with us? What have we not touched on that you would like to... Sure.
Well, okay. Everybody kids me and all the young people and my whole drive is mentoring. For my entire career, I'm mentoring every single day. I have two calls today with young people. So I love mentoring. But I have, one thing is I have about three or four mantras that, I kind of live by. And, the first one is be fun, have fun. And I think, particularly in today's environment, as an entrepreneur, you've got to try to balance your life with some, fun. Also, I always have a smile on my face no matter what. When I was, I walked in the door of the trading card business, the CFO came to me, said, Frank, look at these numbers. The company lost $80 million. And I smiled. No one in that room ever forgot that I smiled, So I always say, just a smile helps so much. People just want to be around fun people. And also I say, always be positive. And that gets you through, so much. And then in my case, it was always running companies was, my first priority was my employees in their personal development, not the company.
Fantastic stuff. Frank, thank you so much for sharing your career and thank you for the book. It comes out. Well, it's available now on pre-order, but it drops on the 25th. So about another week, but you can go ahead and buy it now. This is one that I'm going to be reading, I promise, Frank. Can't wait to read it.
Okay, Jim. Thank you so much for your time. I love the questions.
How do we find out more about you, follow you online, that kind of thing?
Well, the best thing is I have a website, which is jumpfirstthinkfast.com. And then, there is an awful lot. If you look me up on LinkedIn, you'll find an awful lot, and you'll find a lot of comments from my mentors and people who worked with me throughout the year and their messages. So LinkedIn is another, you know, very good source. So
fantastic. Frank, thank you so very much. I hope you and your wife have a wonderful fall there in Vermont. And I hope the snow comes early for you.
Well, thank you. We'll say hi to Middlebury for you.
Oh, I got to get back up there. Frank O'Connell, again, the book is Jump First, Think Fast. Frank, we really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one. You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back. And again, thank you so much for being with us today. Very excited to introduce my next guest. We've been talking for a few minutes now, and we're going to have a great conversation for you now, I promise. Please welcome to the show, Todd Capone. He is author of a new book called The Transparent Sales Leader, How the Power of Sincerity, Science, and Structure Can Transform Your Sales Team's Results. He has been very successful in business and in selling himself, and has won some really cool awards. Most cool, he was part of a successful IPO where he was part of the senior leadership team, an exit valued at $3 billion. He won the Stevie Award for Worldwide Sales of the Year. Pretty damn impressive. And he's also the CEO of Sales Melon, where he does his training. Todd, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Oh, Jim, it's good to be here. Can't wait to dig in.
All right. So transparent sales, I'm going to make 18% off of you. This, I got 18% profit margin on here.
Nice.
That transparent?
Well, I could be. I'll give you the definition of transparency.
Let's start there.
Right. And so it was a revelation that I had a few years ago. I was the chief revenue officer of a tech company in Chicago called Power Reviews. You probably guessed from the name, we were in the review space. So we helped retailers and brands collect and display ratings and reviews on their websites. And you've interacted with them if you bought a pair of Crocs or sweater on Vineyard Vine or whatever. But here's what happened. We had just done a study that looked at consumer behavior around when a website's acting as a salesperson and like, what do people do? There was three data points that came out of it. Two of them changed my life like could only happen